From the highest mountains to the bluest seas, the driest deserts to the icy poles, Kate Turkington has traveled there, and now she's inviting you to travel with her through your radio. Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And a very good morning to you, wherever you are in the world. This is Kate Turkington, and you're on Travels with Kate. And we're going to all kinds of places this morning. Later on, we're going to be going to Zambia and Zimbabwe, the Okavango, Chobe, all kinds of places. But first of all, we're going into the human mind. I'm going to be talking about risk, because I think we're all a bit of a gambler at heart. But let me first of all introduce my guest. It's a bit of a mouthful because he's very important and he's done so much. Don Ross, he's the professor and head of the School of Society, Politics and Ethics, where at the University of Cork in Ireland. He's professor at the School of Economics at the University of Cape Town, and he's the Programme Director for Methodology at the Centre for Economic Analysis of Risk. That's at Georgia State University. All sounds very intimidating, Don. What does he do? He studies the design and interpretation of risky choice experiments with people and other animals. So why is he with us this morning? Because with his co-author, Glenn Harrison, he's written a book called The Gambling Animal, which is subtitled Humanity's Evolutionary Winning Streak and How We Risk It All. I'm going to be talking to you about evolutionary winning streak with AI on the horizon and whatever. But first of all, Don, well, first of all, welcome.
Thank you, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
And now, why? What inspired you to write this book? I mean, you're an economics professor, for goodness sake. How on earth did you think up this, you and your co-author, Glenn Harrison?
Well, Kate, for a microeconomist like myself, what economics is fundamentally about is choice under changing incentives. And of course, it's not just humans who make choices. So for many years in our lab, which is a global lab, we have our head lab in Atlanta, Georgia, and in the US, but we also have a very busy lab at the University of Cape Town. We've got labs in Europe. For many years, we have been bringing people into our lab and performing choice experiments with them that allow us to estimate in a quantitative form, with a quantitative model, the way in which their responses to risk change with circumstances.
Can you give me an example of that, Don?
Yeah. So suppose
you're
our research subject, and you came into our lab, and we would get you to do to run three experimental tasks. And I won't go into all three because the number two and number three are pretty technical, and it would probably use up all our time to explain them. Let me just describe the core task you would perform. So we would give you, to begin with, a pair of lotteries. And we'll call them lottery A and lottery B. And what we mean by a lottery is just a situation in which there's a possible reward and a certain probability assigned to that reward. And since you're a human, if you were an elephant, the rewards would be fruit. But since you're a human, the rewards would be money. And this would be real money on the line. So you, depending on your choice, you would go home with a different amount of money. And we try to make the amounts quite significant because we want our subjects to care about what they're doing. So lottery A would offer you a certain amount of money with a certain probability, say $60 with a 15% probability and $20 with an 85% probability. Let's call that lottery A. And lottery B might offer you $40 with a 50% probability and $20 with a 50% probability.
And you, the subject, makes the choice.
That's right. You as our subject, would choose between lottery A and lottery B. And then we'd move on and we'd give you another pair like that. And you'd again make a choice. And we'd give you a minimum of 40 or so of those. Ideally, a few more for statistical power, and so we can control a few more variables. Ideally, you might do 60 or so of them. And on the at the end of your having made all of those trials, we have designed the lottery pairs in such a way that when we put you through that whole battery, by the end, we've accumulated a lot of statistical evidence about how you respond when we vary conditions in the risk. Again, we have to do a couple of other tasks to use that core information to fully model your, what we call your utility function, the function that describes how changing conditions in the problem you're facing lead to changes in your response.
So what are you trying to do with these experiments? What's the ultimate goal?
To understand how people change their behavior when the risk in the environment shifts. And we've run these experiments now with about 40,000 people all over the world, and from all walks of life on all continents. I mean, so men and women and old people and young people and educated people and illiterate people and innumerate people. And we've done it with shepherds in the hills of Ethiopia. We've done it with fisher people in Ghana and so on, and chief financial officers from big companies. So,
what so far, in layperson's terms, in very broad terms, what have you found out?
So we can put it in two interesting things. So one thing that we did expect, which is that there's quite a range of, there's a range of variation in the way people respond, what we call heterogeneity. That is, there's not one standard human risk preference structure.
Okay.
So we find a mix, and we have mathematical models for all the different kinds of responses we find. But here is the other finding, which has surprised us, but it's very robust after so many people. And that is that in every population we study, with one exception, which I'll mention in a minute, but in every population we've studied, all these ones I described, though we find the pattern of heterogeneity, it's the same pattern. So we find the same distribution of responses in the Ethiopian shepherds, in the university students, in the chief financial officers, and that is a surprising result, a very striking result. The only population we ever studied which departed from the usual distribution of response patterns for reasons we have no clue was a bunch of university students from New Zealand. The University of Auckland students did not behave like normal human beings.
Well, that's New Zealand.
Who knows what?
Wow. Okay, you've got this information, and you've been collecting it for years. What's the purpose of it? What are you going to do with it? I mean, you've written an amazing book about it, but what are you going to do with this information?
Well, it's relevant to almost any policy context, right? Anytime anyone is contemplating a policy which will affect, and there's no point, every policy that's ever enacted is designed to somehow change somebody's behavior. A policy that changes nobody's behavior is, by definition, a policy that makes no difference, and therefore an ineffective policy. But how people will respond to an introduced policy depends on their risk preferences. And so when you're wondering how a population of people will respond to a policy, and policies are always made with the population in mind, not particular individuals generally. So you make a policy that aimed at a population. If you don't have a model of how that population is likely to respond to the changes in the risks that your policy creates, you don't know what your policy is going to do.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And welcome back. I'm Kate Turkington. You're on Travels with Kate. That's so fascinating. I mean, we live in such a chaotic, fascinating inspiring world at the moment. You know, that all the doom and gloom says, but we've been through this before in like the early Elizabethan age, new worlds being found, Galileo, all kinds of on the cusp of great discoveries, which is what we're doing we're doing now. Now, is this where economics comes in, Don? Can you then offer these probabilities to governments, to politicians, to individuals, to whomsoever?
Yes, that's exactly what we do do. The Center for the Economic Analysis of Risk, where I'm a director, is in the business of taking public policy problems and then finding experimental ways to study how the population will might be expected to respond to the specific policy ideas. And of course, we sometimes promote policy ideas of our own. For example, we have a new paper, which is just about to be published in one of the top economics journals, in which we report special studies we did on the different responses by men and women to specific kinds of risk problems we gave, which gave them in the lab, which are designed to replicate the kinds of risk choice problems that arise for people in a workplace typically. And the finding we're reporting is that contrary to a widespread view, women are not more cautious than men. Women do not respond to risk more circumspectly than men do. Rather, men tend to be overconfident in their own estimations of probabilities.
Uh-huh. And interesting.
But that gets hidden in most standard tests, which don't allow people to reflect differences in their confidence level. That is, in many circumstances, they just don't have any way to reflect that fact. And so it's invisible to us when the behavior is studied in the usual ways. We set up the experiment in our lab in such a way that people could make the amount of money they would walk out of the lab with partly a function of their confidence. And what happened? The women went home with substantially more money than the men. So our policy advice is, when you're designing a competitive situation in a workplace, make sure that you find a way to allow the people to express their confidence differences and not just their objective risk preferences.
Because what you're doing here is you're overturning stereotypes.
In the case of that paper, yes, very much so.
Now, gambling, it's inherent in all of us, you think. Ever since we crawled or tottered or wobbled out of the caves at Sterkfontein here in South Africa. Is it inherent or is it a learned behavior?
Any animal that has a brain will gamble. And the reason for that is pretty straightforward.
Decode that for me.
So yeah, just let's take a few facts and put them together. Brains are very expensive for an animal type. So in any animal that has a brain, typically the brain is the most expensive organ in its body. What I mean by expensive is I'm referring to its metabolic cost. That is, what proportion of the nutrition the animal consumes is used to maintain that organ. We can look at all organs that way, livers, kidneys, you name it. Brains are very expensive organs. And humans, along with a few other species like elephants, and have the most expensive brains in the world. So we know that natural selection will not maintain a very, very expensive organ unless it's really important to the organism's fitness. Now, what is the point of having this big, expensive information processing system between your ears? Well, it's to manage the complexity of the environment. No evolution would never design expensive brains if the environment was simple. And animals that live in relatively simple environments typically don't have brains at all, or they have very inexpensive ones. You live in a complex environment, you've got this expensive brain to cope with it. With complexity efficiently, you have to perform little experiments. If you just wait for the complexity, sit back passively and let the complexity bombard you, you will not be able to successfully model it. And then what's the point of having all that brain power? You have to be going along with having a big brain. There has to be a natural disposition to investigate the world, to run little experiments, to be curious. That is to say, to motivate your own risks, to modify the risk environment yourself to see what happens. Well, that's gambling. When you face an uncertain environment, you don't know exactly what the reward contingencies are, you don't exactly know the probabilities, you've got to make your best assessment, you take an action, you see what happens. That's a gamble. Think of a bear for deciding where to forage. Does it go up into the hills where there might be berries? Does it forage in the valley where there might be roots to eat or some small animals to hunt? Which decision it makes could determine whether it has a successful hibernation and gives birth to a cub, to a viable cub while it's hibernating. So the decision matters. What the bear will tend to do is, if it can, is sample both environments when the situation isn't too pressing. So when things are, when there's more on the line, it will have accumulated some information. It might be harvesting berries and doing very well, but it decides, I'm going to take a gamble. I'm going to go down into the valley and see what's going on down there.
Now, what immediately springs to mind, and I know you discuss it quite a bit in your book, The Gambling Animal, you're telling us, basically, we know humans have big brains. They're exponentially experiencing the world. They take risks. They deal with it. What on earth, then, is happening about climate change? Because we see this. We perceive what's going on. Where we've been taking risks for so many years, but we seem to have reached a stop.
Yeah. So one of the basic stories in our book that we tell through the book is let me set this up by just introducing a little puzzle that motivated us. The overwhelming majority of individual people, those 40,000 we looked at, are moderately risk averse, meaning most individual people will pay some resources. Money, for example, will pay some resources in order to reduce the extent of the risk they face. However, when people make decisions collectively, they tend to create institutions. They construct institutions that cause them as a group to behave as if they are risk neutral or risk loving. That is, they combat their own individual risk aversion by setting up institutions that are not risk averse. That is unique to humans as far as we've been able to determine. We're working with elephants now to look at the contours of that in another species. And this has resulted in the following history of human civilization. We tend to deal collectively with risks in exactly the way that your financial advisor will tell you to deal with your risks when you go to her and ask how you should invest your pension savings. That is, she will say, as your investable resources expand, diversify your portfolio. Spread your risk around into a variety of different places and sites. What that means you're doing is expanding the risk environment. There's a certain specific risk profile if all you have are some government bonds. And there's another narrow specific risk profile if all you have are a few index funds in the stock exchange. But as your wealth grows, you mix that up and you make a bigger, more complex portfolio. That's how humans have handled basic risk through their whole history. We look at early agricultural civilizations and how they tended to behave when they overstressed their environment. The response usually was that elites would move away from the overstressed environment while leaving less elite people behind to harvest the resources from the environment that was failing. And in the meantime, those elites would expand the risk territory for them, meaning often geographical expansion. So make the civilization bigger, or in some cases, they would They would expand through creating new technology, would also widen the risk profile.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
We're talking to Dom Ross about his book that he co-wrote with Prof. Glenn Harrison called The Gambling Animal. And his thesis is how humans, ever since those early, early days, have had to be risk takers, actually, to evolve and to face the present risk. But now, let's use a bit of a gambling analogy. Would you say the world, politician, countries, this is a huge generalization, Don, but are they rolling the dice over climate change? Are they? I mean, what are they doing? What's the gamble? And what are the risks of the gamble?
So let me just finish the little story I started before we had that unfortunate interruption. Notice what we're doing. Every time we expand the risk environment or the risk profile, either through technological innovation or through increasing the sizes of our civilizations, every time we always deal with a smaller scale risk problem by creating a larger scale risk. And then we embed that larger scale risk in yet another wider portfolio with more new technology or more expansion. So we keep increasing the reach of our risk problems in order to solve smaller scale risk problems. We refer to this in the book as the risk ratchet. You can describe the whole history of humanity as this ratchet in which we constantly keep bundling up, making bigger and bigger and more extensive and more complex the risk portfolios that we face collectively. Now, here's the problem, of course. Eventually, you can't turn the ratchet anymore because you've bundled up everything, right? Once the whole population of the world faces a risk challenge that is itself global, once we actually have the whole environment, our entire environment at stake, it's no longer possible to expand that. And you see this reflected in some foolish ideas that have provenance now. So Elon Musk, for example, thinks that we should continue our risk ratchet approach by colonizing Mars. But one only has to think for a minute to realize that makes very little sense because Mars is not habitable unless we basically create a dome to live in. That's a ridiculous response to climate change and biodiversity collapse, because consider what's going to happen as a result of climate change, among other things. Most of Africa will become uninhabitable because it'll be too hot for people. Well, but wait a minute. Why would we respond to an Africa in which we would have to live under a dome if we want people to stay there? Why would we respond to that by going to another place where we also have to live under a dome? Right? The answer to an uninhabitable Africa is not to go to an uninhabitable planet. That isn't a sensible way of continuing the ratchet strategy and expanding the risk base. So we have a crisis because the strategy we have followed as a species throughout our history has now hit a kind of wall. We just no longer have anything to put in the bundle, add to the bundle, no way of expanding our risk bundle because the bundle's now got everything in it.
It's a mistake. So far, humankind, the risks have paid off. We've got, I always love the way he put it, Prof. Lee Berger at Wits always says, you know, we trotted out of the caves at Sterkfontein, we got ourselves up Africa, across the land bridge, we finally got ourselves to the moon. I love that. I mean, it's a 101 simplistic, but do you think we'll cope?
So Lieberger's point is well taken in one respect. We are indeed highly adaptable. That also comes with having these very expensive brains. And so I think it is, in fact, very unlikely that however much damage we ended up inflicting on the Earth, it is very unlikely we will actually go extinct as a species. However, we have built an extremely complex global civilization, and complex civilizations or complex structures in general are fragile because they depend on the interaction of so many systems. So I think what is sometimes called civilizational collapse, and I'll refer here to another South African, the economist Wim Nodier, who published a book last year called Economic Growth and Civilizational Collapse that I I think it's an excellent book. And he tries to work through the likely way in which, due to the specific vulnerabilities in our global civilization and the way climate change is likely to unfold, he analyzes how the civilizational collapse will likely manifest itself.
Okay,
so we will survive, but we will likely survive in smaller communities.
Okay, final question. We've got about 30 seconds. If you were a betting man, would you gamble on us as a probability of enduring?
I think we will endure, but we will face some very, very hard times on the path ahead. So I do not expect our current form of civilization to endure, but I expect human beings to endure. And probably our descendants who survive what's coming will then start up a whole new ratchet process.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you so much. So much. So much food for thought. That's Professor Don Ross. He wrote the book with Glenn Harrison, and it's called The Gambling Animal, subtitle being Humanity's Evolutionary Winning Streak, we hope. I'm adding the we hope bit, and how we risk it all. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Kate, for the excellent questions. Thank you.
This is Kate Turkington on Travels with Kate, only on 101.9 High FM.
And welcome back. I'm Kate Turkington. You're on Travels with Kate. My word, what an interesting discussion that was with Prof Don Ross there, who's at UCT and at universities in Georgia and called the gambling animal. Didn't have time to ask him, but I thought about asking him, did he have a roulette system? Just a joke. Okay, I want to tell you about an amazing trip I did, and I'd recommend all these places heartily. I did it actually about 14, 15 months ago, and it was just to neighbouring countries, to Botswana, to Zimbabwe, to Zambia, and then back to Botswana. I went off to the Okavango, one of my favourite places on earth. I was very lucky. I flew to Maun in Botswana and then was taken by helicopter to a lovely little camp called Chacha Metsi. It's in a leadwood forest by a perennial lagoon. So you've got four rented rooms, two family rooms. It's not five-star luxury, but it's really comfortable Okavango-style stuff. If you've never been, it's certainly a place I'd recommend you to go to. You know, it's very, very hard to get to the Okavango by yourself, even if you've got a suitable vehicle and you're an experienced camper. You never know whether the planes are going to be in flood, whether the roads are going to be open. I mean, it's great if you can do it. But rather go with a respected operator or go somewhere. You know, what's so nice about Chacha Metsi, because it's quite a newish camp, it's all solar powered. So, of course, you can charge your phones at night. There's a place in the main tent where you can charge more. Otherwise, totally solar. But lovely little camp. And, of course, if you're a birder, which I am, you can't beat the Botswana birds of the storks and the herons and everything there. Anyway, we had three nights at Chacha Metsi, and then we went off to the Safari Club Hotel at the Vic Falls. Now, the Vic Falls, again, is one of my favourite places on earth. I've been to many of the other great waterfalls of the world, from Iguazu Falls last year, in fact, to many moons ago, to the Great Falls in America. None for me can beat the Big Fours. And one of the reasons is they're totally uncommercialized. You still walk along that little paved path, you know the one if you've been there, by the waterfall. There's nothing between you and the gorge below except a little fence of thorns, maybe a slightly stronger fence here and now, but not very often. And you walk along that long, long path all the way along the pass from the Devil's Cauldron through the main ford. And if it's about just over a kilometre, I actually did it on my watch this year. I've got one of these watches that tells you stuff. And finally, you end up at that bridge across the Zambezi River, which links Zambia and Botswana and Zimbabwe. And of course, there you've got the bungee jump. So it's so amazing just to stand there and watch the bungee jumpers throw themselves off the bridge. It's something I've never done. I've done most things, but I've never, ever fancied bungee jumping. But when I read the title, the name of the Safari Club Hotel at the Vic Falls, I thought, is it going to be like a sort of standard road hotel or whatever? It was absolutely gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous rooms, gorgeous views, wonderful service, great food. And what they have that is so interesting, and they've had it for years and years and years, they have what they call a vulture restaurant. So at 1 o'clock every day, the vultures are fed. And it's so interesting because you go to a lookout point, you can walk down with the guide to the actual feeding site, you can stand on the veranda and watch or whatever, choose whatever you want to. But about 1:45 each day, first a black speck appears in the sky, then a second black speck, then a few black specks and dozens of black specks and hundreds and sometimes thousands of vultures. The sky is dark with these birds because they know they're going to be fed. So the guy goes down with a big cooler box of meat, Lord knows what it is, donkey meat, whatever. And the vultures come down and in minutes, all that meat is gone. So it's a wonderful chance to get vulture photographs. They're mainly the white-backed and the hooded that come down, but it's an amazing sight. And it's quite free. Even if you're not staying at the hotel, you can still rock up at just before 1 to see the vulture restaurant. And some of our party, not me, I've done it before, went whitewater rafting. And of course, they all fell out and fell under the boat, but they all survived, came back a bit shaken. There were a couple in their 70s, but they did it and had that to chalk up. And then we did, they've restarted this. There's something called the Bamba Tram, and you can take the Bamba Tram over that Vic Falls Bridge. And if you do it at sunrise, which we do, you really get an old tram, clackety old tram with old wooden seats. And it's like something on a little noddy, but it's been going, or they've resurrected it after years and years. So you buy your ticket and you go along and you watch the sunrise there at off the bridge. And then just finally through Livingstone in Zambia, great little museum in Livingstone. If ever you're there, you can see Kenneth Condor's motorbike, you can see Dr. Livingstone's medical bag. And we went to Royal Chundo, beautiful, beautiful five-star lodge in Zambia. I'll have to tell you more about that another time. And finally, because again, this is an innovation, to Chobe Safari Lodge, where Elizabeth Taylor got married to Richard Burton for the second time. And I've actually slept in that bit, not in this occasion. But what's so super about that safari lodge, apart from location, it has the first ever solar-powered vehicles and boats. And plus, it has the first ever females-only guiding team in Africa. They're called the Chobe Angels, only female guides. So lots of new things happening. And many of you, I'm sure, will have been to Chobe Safari Lodge. Still as great as ever. And Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe, still, obviously depends where you go, but as great as ever. So those were my fairly recent travels, a trip I'd do again in a heartbeat, let me tell you. And in the meantime, I'll see you all next week. Look after yourselves, travel safely wherever you're going. And it's so good to see how South African tourism is surging at the moment, Wherever you go, I did a trip recently all through Mpumalanga and Kruger. Russians, Italians, French, Dutch, South Americans, you name it, our tourism is booming. So you travel safely, take care of yourselves, and of course, take care of others too.